This is a Federal News Network podcast.
The Defense Department recently brought the Chief Data and Artificial Intelligence Office into full operating capability. It'll focus on advanced technologies and working fast. Not just the technologies need to move fast, though. Acquisition and contracting also have to keep pace with the office's needs. Federal News Network's Scott Massioni talked about this with procurement analyst Bonnie Evangelista and contracting chief Catherine Crompton.
There's a lot of direct reports up, and so all four of those agencies, which had very, not similar, but overlapping mission sets or mission sets that really we could get a lot of good out if they were together working as a unit versus separate, just more efficient. That is what led to the creation of the CDAO, is that us working together could have more impact and influence across the DoD as it relates to scaling, as it relates to delivering capability, and kind of addressing some of those challenges that they've seen across those agencies.
And so underneath of your office, you have Jake in there. You have a couple of other interesting AI type organizations. You know, what are you trying to accomplish with this organization in terms of, you know, what Jake was doing, and how is this sort of progressing that?
So everything that the Jake is doing has rolled into the CDAO, and what Advana was doing and what DS and what CDO was doing, it's all now come into this organization. So what Jake is doing has now spread out between those different directorates. So Jake was already had the acquisition authority. So the goodness that was created at the Jake with the acquisition authority has now come under the acquisition director. And the ADA initiatives that has gone under enterprise capabilities, I believe, you know, synergizing Advana with those capabilities. So all the goodness that was there is now in this bigger organization to gain those synergies. So that we can scale it better.
I believe, from my perspective, CDAO is looking to set the standard, mm-hmm. a new standard potentially for acquiring AI and digital mm-hmm. for across the department. And so in order to do that, there has to be broad oversight and, you know, ability for us to collectively start to take all these different places of goodness and make and scale it to greatness.
Mm-hmm. You're in charge of the contracting in this new office. What is your approach going to be in terms of ensuring there's speed and agility, ensuring that you're reaching out to industry in the ways that you are hoping to, especially considering the timelines that you're working with versus, you know, a ship or a tank or whatever?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. So I think our goal is to remove those roadblocks. So the statement has been made is contracting should not get in the way of mission, which is correct. Contracting should not get in the way of the mission. But traditionally, people feel contracting gets in the way of mission because there's a lot of other things. Like, we're kind of like that gatekeeper. So when we're getting ready to award, we're the people who are making sure compliance is done. We're the people making sure documents are done. So one of the things that we are doing is we are trying to get people to put us in at the beginning. So many, many times contracting, people think contracting is at the end. Or sometimes people make distinction that acquisition and contracting are one and the same. You know, contracting is an enablement. We are the people who should be able to enable that purchase power, that buying power for those goods to be delivered, but we're not acquisition. So my goal is to delegate down. I think that's very, very important. A lot of times we're very risk adverse, so we put a lot of levels of review or a lot of not value add processes into our contracting processes. So we're going to delegate down. We are going to look at bringing the end user in more. One of the questions we ask all the time is, what does the end user need? What does the end user want? Is the end user going to be in the evaluation? Looking at what authorities are out there. There's a lot of deviations, and there's a lot of different authorities types. Which ones do we need? Bringing those into our portfolio. DAU actually, or might be the acquisition website, there's a contracting cone, and it lays out it looks like a fan, and it lays out a multitude of authorities. And so many times in contracting, we're focusing on two or three max of those wedges, when really to be able to deliver, we have to look at all of it. So like, what of those authorities? Do we need to look at PIAs? Do we need to look at CRADAs? Should we have CBER? You know, there's a lot of different things, and how do we get those and have those mechanisms available so we can enable? Contracting should be about enablement.
I'm actually less concerned about the contracting and execution part, because I think we can smash that button all day long. And one of the ways, we look at every opportunity and try and figure out how to make it a buying mechanism, whether it's an event or an online conference or something like that. If government people are there looking at solutions, like, why can't we leverage that already? So taking things that are already happening, create and using the flexibilities and some of the authorities that Katie's talking about and turning them into actual buying opportunities,
right.
That's one. And then I'm actually really excited more because we are CDAO and we have a big A, as we like to say, acquisition focus, turning the limelight on all of acquisition. And I think the keynote speaker mentioned that this morning, like, their acquisition is more than just contracting, and looking at all the elements of acquisition and trying to do the exact same thing, trying to figure out how do we increase maximize flexibility and optimize. I like Katie mentioned, for sure, removing barriers, 100%.
Yeah, a lot of times people think, you know, to Bonnie's point, and this is something we have tried and I think we'll continue to try to do, is maximize our opportunities, is, you know, allowing our people to be empowered to try things different. So many times it's, oh, you need to put out and request a 100-page proposal back, or you need to do this very extensive tech evaluation. You know, really, can you tell me in an oral presentation? Can you send me in a video? Like an event like this, like what we're at right here, where industry and stuff is together, they've already spent time, they've already spent money. Is there a way for us to sit here and talk to them now and have them give us a proposal and we can consider it to be competitive so we can take that information back? Which we have done that before. We called it a Coliseum, where in a very short time frame, we were able to go through hundreds of evaluations and do a multitude, almost 90 one-on-ones with industry in less than 3 days, and make award decisions, which have now transitioned into warfighters' hands. But, you know, we have bandwidth problems as the government. Industry has bandwidth problems. And how can we create mechanisms that allows us to gain that information, consider it to be competitive, so that we can get things faster?
Yeah, and we're going to double down a little bit on finding those underutilized, whether it's authorities or flexibilities. For example, merit-based procurement is, I think, heavily underutilized. Mm-hmm. In Tradewind, we're going to be entering a highly focused merit-based model where we're going to develop, curate, and market like 3-minute video pitches, and we're going to call it the Tradewind Marketplace, and every video in this marketplace is going to be awardable. So that's one way, again, we're reducing barriers to entry.
Bonnie Evangelista, procurement analyst at the Chief Data and Artificial Intelligence Office at the Defense Department, and Catherine Crompton, the office's contracting chief, speaking with Federal News Network's Scott Massioni. Check out Scott's story at federalnewsnetwork.com.
Hello, I'm WIPA CEO Shane Canfield, and thank you for joining us on another episode of Lessons in Leadership. I'm honored to be joined by Angie Bailey, founder and CEO of Ananda Life. Angie has a remarkable career in public service, beginning as a GS-2 clerk typist with the Social Security Administration. And over the next 40 years, Angie steadily worked her way up through the government, ultimately becoming the Chief Human Capital Officer at the Department of Homeland Security. She's been recognized with presidential rank awards by 2 administrations for leadership, innovation, dedication, and commitment to the country. Angie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Shane. What a pleasure to be here.
Angie, you've made quite a name for yourself as a leader in the federal workforce. Who was the first person you remember looking up to as a leader, and what about them inspired you?
You know, I often think about this because, you know, sometimes we think of the people that we look up to the most as being somebody that throughout our career has, you know, been at the highest levels and all. But, I've got to go back to, honestly, whenever I was 10 years old. And I remember I really wanted to play Little League baseball on a boys team. I was the only girl. And interestingly, it was the women who would keep saying to me that, no, I couldn't play. And then one day, whenever I was there to sign up yet again, there was this guy, his name was Delbert Beiser. And I remember he had like red hair and he had a wad of tobacco in his mouth and greasy overalls and everything. And he said, you know, I'll take her on my team. And, you know, just looking back on that, there are so many leadership lessons and things that I just really admire about him. And actually, I thought about throughout my entire career, he took a chance on somebody he didn't know. He put aside whatever conscious or unconscious biases that he might have had about having a girl on a team. He treated me the same. Whether, you know, if I wasn't performing, I got benched just like the boys. I got no special treatment. And he was just really honest with me and he just included me in everything. And so looking back on it, you know, really, it was Delbert Beiser, our local mechanic in our little small village, that was, I think, my inspiration for going on to, I hope, become the leader, you know, that I wanted to be.
I'd say half of the guests on this podcast have had similar stories where they reach back to either childhood or young adulthood. And I think as leaders, it's really incumbent upon us to keep that in mind, that what we say and do, especially in the younger ages, really can have a lifelong impact. How would you describe your leadership style and how's that developed over time?
I would say that the one word that describes my leadership style is that I care. I guess that's more than one word, but I care. I've always cared about the mission. I've always cared about the people. I've always cared, you know, about making sure that they had what they needed or that they were developing the way, you know, that they aspired to develop. And I tried to take this approach of not treating people the way I wanted to be treated, but instead treat people the way they want to be treated. And I think that really kind of developed over my career. You know, I started out just like most leaders do, where it's very results driven. It's all about the bottom line. You need to make sure that you get everything accomplished because, you know, that's what everybody's looking for, the goals, the metrics, et cetera. But I think as you mature and you go along, you start to your point, you draw back on those early childhood days or early adult, young, you know, whenever you're a young adult, and you say, you know, I think that there's a little bit more to this than just the bottom line. And so over time, I really began to, I think, see a much bigger picture and the entire ecosystem, if you will, and how the people themselves fit into all of this. And that ultimately, at the end of the day, it was all about the people. And so, I think my maturity allowed me to then shift and focus more on the people than so much on results and bottom line.
You've been recognized with two Presidential Rank Awards, two different administrations. You founded your own company. Tell us a little bit more about your background from the beginning and how did that lead you to where you are today?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting, like you said, that I started out as a GS-2 Social Security Administration. I mean, what I really wanted to be was a criminal prosecuting attorney. That was absolutely my dream. I sometimes joke and say what I really wanted to be was a mafia don, but that wasn't going to work out. So, you know, had to be a criminal prosecuting attorney. But, you know, I had to get a job to pay for college. It wasn't in the cards that I was going to be able to go to college without a job. So I applied at the at the unemployment office. And lo and behold, I got a job at Social Security. I didn't even know it was federal, to be honest. From there, I went to the Department of Defense and I found this career field called labor and employee relations. And honestly, it was as close as I was going to get to being a criminal prosecuting attorney. I didn't go on to be a criminal prosecuting attorney, but I went on courtesy of Department of Defense to get both my bachelor's and my master's in leadership, because the whole study of leadership, I just find incredibly fascinating, you know, from historical to current times. It's just something that's just really fascinated me. And so I would say I'm a lifelong learner of leadership. And then I would say some of the other things that got me maybe where I am today is I never really said no to anything. If people asked me to take on a new challenge, even if I wasn't sure I was going to be successful at it, I would say, you know what, not sure this is going to work out, but more than happy to give it a try. And it always worked out. But I think giving things a try and just not saying no to opportunities is what really led from one position to the next. I feel like I was always rewarded for just stepping in or stepping up and taking on the challenges that sometimes no one else wanted to do.
Angie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Shane. It's such a pleasure. I really appreciate you giving me this opportunity. Thank you.
This has been the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I'm CEO of WEPA, Shane Canfield. Looking forward to talking to you next time.
Hey, scientists, how critical is pure water to you? In this new podcast, Lab Water Stories Unfiltered, we at Millipore Sigma look closer at this often overlooked lab essential. Tune in as experts drop tips and insights not found in textbooks, taken from their work with Millikue Lab Water Solutions. Lab Water Stories Unfiltered. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. Millipore Sigma is the U.S. and Canada life science business of Merck KGaA Darmstadt, Germany.